land is very, very fertile. And I might add that before 1965, when sanctions were imposed on Rhodesia as it was then, Rhodesia used to be the world's largest producer of, would you believe, tobacco. And the one country that benefited the most from sanctions was this country. Because when sanctions were imposed on Rhodesia, the United States then became the world's largest producer of tobacco. And now that Zimbabwe is back, we are challenging once again the U.S. supremacy in production of tobacco. So the land is very fertile. We can grow just about anything. The climate is somewhat like California. We have a minimum of 8 hours sunshine every day. And temperatures are very mild, between 60 and 75 throughout the year. We have a reasonable amount of rainfall, not quite as much as Oregon or Washington, but considerably more than, say, Southern California. The yellow is for the minerals, and we produce such minerals as gold, chrome, cobalt, nickel, cadmium, vanadium, silver, tin, nickel, coal, copper, emeralds. No oil yet, but I'm hoping that before too long we may find some oil in my backyard. So the yellow is for the minerals. The red is for the blood that was shed fighting for that independence. Whenever we look at it, we will always remember the people that fought so much to liberate Zimbabwe. The black is the color of the majority of the people. Okay, this is not the whole flag. In the whole flag, which you might have seen on Jack Trump's door, there is also a red star, which symbolizes a new beginning, a new Zimbabwe, a new dawn. And then on that same flag, there is also a bird, which some American journalists have confused with a rooster, since a rooster was supposed to be the symbol of the ruling party in Zimbabwe right now, which is ZANU. But that bird was discovered among the ruins of Zimbabwe because there used to be an empire where Zimbabwe is today called the Zimbabwe Empire. That's where Zimbabwe actually gets its name, the Empire of Zimbabwe, that flourished sometime between roughly 500 AD to about 1600 AD. And if you read your Portuguese history, you'll hear about the Portuguese trading with the people in Zimbabwe about that time. Also discovered that when we're digging through the ruins that have survived to this day from that era, we discovered artifacts and objects from China and Japan, indicating that the Shona people, the Zimbabwe people, were trading with Japan and China roughly 500 AD, about 1,000 years before Vasco da Gama quote-unquote discovered the route to India. So those are the symbols on the flag. And also there is a white triangle, which has been explained by the Prime Minister as the advent of peace to Zimbabwe, because this to us is a very, very significant event for the first time in about 9 decades. We don't hear the sound of gunfire anymore, and that is quite a relief. So we are looking ahead, and like I mentioned last night, all that's left now is for all Zimbabweans to join together, hold hands, and rebuild a future. And the most important thing now is that each and every one of us will be expected to play a part. And I'd like to mention the one significant change that has taken place in Zimbabwe, and that is that for the first time, women are being taken seriously. I say that almost tongue-in-cheek, but it's serious. The government has made an effort and has created what we call a Department of Women's Affairs, realizing that when we were fighting our war of independence, women were a viable and very significant part of the liberation forces, they not only tended to the sick, providing medical services and keeping the, looking after the camps, they actually were commanders in the field, actually holding submachine guns and the like, fighting, you know, for our independence, because they realized that the days when women were supposed to stay in the kitchen are long since over. And in Zimbabwe, this is significant because when the constitution, the new constitution was written, this was one of the fundamental freedoms spelled out, the right of women's equality to men. And in the cabinet right now, there are three women ministers, which is a first. Deputy Minister of Education, for example, is a woman. And the Minister of Youth, Sport and Culture is a woman. The Minister of Social Services, Deputy Minister of Social Services, I think, is a woman. And in the last elections that were held also, women gained a significant portion of the seats in Parliament. We call them members of Parliament. They're the equivalent of your representatives in that they represent a certain segment of the population. And this has been the cornerstone of Prime Minister Mugabe's program. He has said that we fought in Zimbabwe so that, and our argument when we were fighting for Zimbabwe was that we are as good as anybody. We should be given that opportunity. And therefore, it would not make sense for us to say, Africans are as good as anybody. Africans are as good as whites, that is. And yet turn around and say, well, but women are not quite as good as we are. And so I'm very much encouraged. And once again, I would like to take this moment to mention the role that the outside people have played in Zimbabwe's liberation. And what I'd like to talk about today is the fact that the role of the outside world has not ended with Zimbabwe's attainment of independence. As Zimbabwe stumbles, takes the first few stumbling steps towards nationhood, the world should remain watchful and ever alert to the, so that if we make a mistake, we'd like you to point out and say, we don't think that is right. Well, you should go ahead and do it this way. During the last administration, during the last Rhodesian administration, you were very vocal in pointing out all the injustices. Simply because we've won our independence now does not mean that we have overcome everything. We are still learning almost every day, and your input will be very valuable. And also, we are looking at Zimbabwe as a very useful experiment in the sense that we realize there is a lot of tension throughout the world today, war, rumors of the war, and all those things. And in Zimbabwe, on the other hand, as well as in much of Southern Africa, we are moving towards an entirely different objective and a different direction, which is the land of coexistence. We are saying that the world is a beautiful place because we are all so different, and because of our different cultural backgrounds and our different heritages, it makes the world that much more beautiful because we can each bring a different input. That is why the experiment in Zimbabwe should be encouraged by the rest of the world, because if that can work in Zimbabwe, there is no reason that it cannot work in, say, South Africa, in Namibia, in Thailand, in Nicaragua, and any other place where there is tension. I'm encouraged that, like I said, I can go back home with the knowledge that the reign of terror is over. That if I see the government making a mistake, I can write to the government and say, I think we need a new school in this village here. We have so many students. If I had said that before, that would have been a one-way ticket to jail indefinitely. But if I say that now, I'll actually get a response from the government saying, Mr. Kumbula, we believe your suggestion is reasonable, but for these reasons, maybe we don't have enough money right now, but when we get enough money, we shall build a school. Or alternatively, we welcome your suggestion, and we will build this school as soon as we can. Because for some reason, the government in Zimbabwe has decided that it was the people that put it in power, and therefore it will not become the master of the people, but rather the servant of the people, serving the people and doing what is best for the people. That's why this t-shirt of mine says Consolidating People's Power, 1981, the year of Consolidating People's Power. The success of Zimbabwe, like I say, will have a lot of great impact on Zimbabwe, on Zambia and Zaire. And also, the most encouraging thing that I find about Zimbabwe, apart from just being a very good experiment, is the fact that the leadership, the young leadership in Zimbabwe, seems to be coming up with an international concept, not an insular concept, but an outward-looking concept, in the sense that right now I look at myself as a Zimbabwean, yes, but also as an African, meaning that the borders that separate Zimbabwe from Zambia are, in my estimation, artificial. I should look beyond the borders of Zimbabwe and Zambia and into Mozambique and so forth, so that whatever I do, whatever education I have, whatever experience I have, can only be useful if I use it to help as many different people as possible. And also, our Prime Minister has always said time and time again that one of the worst things that colonialism imposed upon us was this concept of elitism, whereby if I went to school and got an education, got a degree in whatever field, I'd come back home and want to put my feet up and say, look at me, I have acquired so much. The Prime Minister has instead turned around and said, he has 5 degrees, by the way, 5 degrees in 5 different fields, law, economics, medicine, and I forget what the others are. But he has said, my education is only so useful if I can come back and be able to fit into the society. In other words, go in and be one of the people and not be somewhere, place myself up on a pedestal. And this goes right along with the African concept that we used to have a long time ago, which was that if we do not have enough money to send all the children to school, what we do is we all sacrifice and send one of us to school. And when he comes back, he's the one that is going to work and try to uplift all of us. By the same token, I consider myself very lucky to have been able to have the opportunity to go to school. I got to go to school not because I was the smartest, but simply because everything fell into place just at the right time. And so I must never forget that. I will therefore and must therefore return to Zimbabwe with that concept, that idea, that the education I have, I'm only keeping it for the other people. And I can look ahead to, say, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, when Zimbabwe is economically viable. And one of the things that I like best is that right now I can say, why don't you come and visit me in Zimbabwe next year, or the year after, or the year after. If I had spoken to you, say, 3 years ago, I would have said, whatever you do, stay away from Rhodesia. And this would have been bad news, because since I've stayed with you, I've played with you, I've eaten with you, and I've had such a good time. It is in the African tradition for me to invite you now and say, now that you've been so good to me, come and let me be good to you. Come and visit me and come and see where we live. So I'm looking ahead and thinking that the problems I'm going to have to contend with are a lot more reasonable. I would like to go and work in the area of conservation. Some of us had an opportunity to see wildlife last night, and you saw those beautiful animals, but you also saw the threat of poachers and the threat of people that mostly the wealthy in the Western countries would like to have fur coats, minks, and all those other fancy things. They can have those things, but they are destroying our wildlife. I'd also like to work in the area of the conservation of the land, as well as fighting pollution of the rivers, the atmosphere, That's why I was interested in environmental sciences. And to me, these problems are a lot more interesting than fighting, trying to convince somebody that I am a Zimbabwean too, and I deserve to be treated just like you. Well, these are just some of the few thoughts I had to share with you, and I was most encouraged by coming to Holden Village because it gave me an opportunity, like I said, to meet people from so many different walks of life. It seemed like when we were talking that we talked on an equal footing. This is the kind of lesson that I would certainly hope the people, the whites in South Africa would learn, because the blacks in South Africa and the blacks in Namibia have said time and time again, over and over, that we want to share and share alike. The country is big enough for all of us. We're hoping that what we are demonstrating in Zimbabwe will encourage them to, will encourage the whites in South Africa to begin to question the propaganda that they've been fed all these years. They'll begin to question and say, if Mugabe is such a good leader and beneficial to the whole country, isn't it just possible that if we were to elect, let's say, a Nelson Mandela Prime Minister of South Africa, or any of the other leaders from the majority population, that you would have no option but to be just as reasonable? And if we were to elect a Sam Nujoma in Namibia to head a majority government, wouldn't that make more sense? Then the war would be over and we can concentrate instead on fighting disease and economic stagnation. They are beginning to question these things, the whites in South Africa, and we are hoping that with the prodding that they might get from conscientious people like the gathering here, that these questions will be raised more and more. Because our ultimate goal, as I have said again and again, and I keep repeating it because it is very, very important to me and to you and to everyone that is concerned about Southern Africa, is that we would like to see peace return to Southern Africa. There is so much potential, so much that can be done in Southern Africa if only the people are given an opportunity to work together as they are beginning to do in Zimbabwe. And so, with these few words, I think I can ask for whatever questions you might have.
I'd like to know, you say they're giving women equal status now.
Mm-hmm.
Did, prior to this time, were women given the opportunity for equal education?
No. Not under the last government. The last government was not just racist, but it was also very sexist. For example, the way it treated black people was that it was slightly easier for me to get an education than it was for a black woman, for example. And by the same token, it was when it came to participation in the government or any other meaningful participation in the country, even white women were excluded. They never did take part. All they were allowed to do was to stay in the kitchen and sometimes powder their noses and supposedly look beautiful.
Well, then the women who are in these administrative positions, you were talking about the three mm-hmm. government agencies, they would not be equally as educated then as the fellas in those positions right now.
They are, because what they were able to do was they were able to leave the country too and go and study outside. So we do have a lot of women, black women, that have been educated. But all I was saying is that it was a lot more difficult for them mm-hmm. to get the opportunities than it was, say, for me.
I have a question relating to land ownership and land use planning and the problem of crop production. Let's say that this has occurred in Central America where the cropland is utilized to produce cash crops for the American market rather than for local consumption. In other words, things like cotton and tobacco. Are you looking at some kind of a balance between tobacco, which brings in dollars, and corn, which feeds empty stomachs? And who owns the land in Zimbabwe in this type of
Okay, that is a very involved question in the sense that just before independence, we had this situation where the whites owned 50% of the land, even though they only constituted 4% of the population. The blacks were only allowed 50% of the land, even though they were 96% of the population. So as you can see, whites owned anywhere from 100 to 1,000 times as much land as the blacks did. That's why you hear so much about whites being the productive sector in the economy, and them producing virtually everything in the economy. This was because of the inequitable distribution of land. And also, you have the idea that the government was subsidizing white farmers, but not black farmers. They tended to produce mostly cash crop, but they also produced corn a lot. I mentioned last night the fact that we produced 2 million tons surplus of corn. So corn to us is like our staple diet. There is a, you see, like I said, the war in Zimbabwe lasted almost 15 years. And one of the things that the government, that the current government was doing during those 15 years was it was planning all these things. It had looked at Mozambique. Mozambique was our best example. Because after Mozambique got its independence, they had so many problems, like one of them was feeding the people. The second one was that the problem we have mentioned of trying to produce cash crops instead of food crops. What we discovered was that that was counterproductive, because even if we did get to sell the cash crops, we still had to go and use that same money to buy food from outside. So one of the plans that the government has right now is to buy that land from the white farmers. Unfortunately, the constitution that was drafted in London for Zimbabwe does not allow the government to just go ahead and take the land. That is good. That is both good and bad. Good in the sense that it does not cause an immediate disruption of production, but bad in the sense that it still means that the government must come up with some money to get this land back. One of the plans that the government has in the end is to have every Zimbabwean have at least 12 acres of land. And those that want more, in other words, I'll go home as a medical biologist, but I must still have 12 acres of land. Because every Zimbabwean must now become productive, and so that we become not just self-sufficient in terms of food, but we always have a surplus to fall back on and to export to those other countries that are not quite as fortunate. So there is a definite attempt to make a balance between cash crops and food crops.
What is the nature of the land reform or land distribution process? I mean, I assume that the land won't remain simply in the hands of the white farmers, that some process of redistribution of land is to take place.
Yes,
does the government purchase it? Are new lands being opened up? Or what's the nature of the...
That problem is being attacked in several different ways. Like I said, the agreement that we signed in London does not allow the government to just go ahead and take land. However, that agreement allows the government to go and take land that is not utilized. Mm-hmm. Because in the last stages of the war, a lot of white farmers ran away, just abandoned their farms. So the government has been taking those farms and distributing them to the Africans. And the last estimate I had was that they had settled like 200,000 families just in the last 9 months. 200,000 families have been resettled on some of this underutilized land. When we went to that international donors conference, we were specifically asking for money to be able to buy some of these white farmers out and then give that land to the people. We've been promised, like I said, $2 billion. And I think it's about 40% of that is supposed to go towards purchasing land. At the same time, the government is also opening up other land that never was used for farming. Because the estimate from our Ministry of Manpower, our Ministry of Economic Planning and Development, is that so far only about 25% of our land is being used for farming. But you know, only 25% of the available land is under farming right now, so there's still that other 75% which can be used as money comes in. The major problem is trying to get the machinery like tractors and other farming equipment to get these farms going again. But from the beginning that we have seen in just the first year alone, it looks very positive. I'm wondering what I'll do with my 12 acres of land. Probably grow figs and become Fungai the fig farmer. And the next time I come to Holden, I'll bring you some fungi figs. Yes.
Well, you say each person will have 12 acres, so if there's a family, then you will have 12 and your wife would have 12, and then your children as they grow would they also receive land, so that, you know, if there were some families that had maybe several children, that they could have quite a large?
That is the idea, yes, but that will depend on the particular family. You know, for some people, 12 acres is a lot of land, and they may decide not to go and get any extra land.
But they don't have to accept the 12 acres.
No. Every family is supposed to have 12 acres.
Well, every family. Oh,
yes.
Okay.
But if you want more over and above the 12, then it is available to you. The idea is just so that every family has a minimum of 12 acres.
Okay. I didn't hear family. I heard
every individual. Oh, okay.
Okay, there were an enormous number of refugees living in neighboring states.
Mm-hmm.
What is the process by which they are repatriated and settled on the land? I mean, did they go back to their homes and work from there? Are they moved into the new areas where new lands are being opened up? How is that proceeding?
That also has proceeded along several different lines. Okay, some of them that had fled to the neighboring countries had left because their villages were destroyed. Now, so most of those are returning to their original villages and just setting up once again. Others, on the other hand, have no place to return to because there just isn't anything. You know, if the place was totally destroyed, you have a choice of either going back there and trying to start afresh or going to the government and asking for a different place to settle. And what the government has done is it has encouraged most of those to return to their original homes and take it from there. And also at the same time, it has begun buying this extra land and giving it to the refugees returning. So it's being settled in several different steps.
Are there a large number of refugees left? There must be. There's a huge number of them.
The figures we had were ranged from 1 million to 1.5 million that had fled. And I was reading the latest report. It said that virtually all of them have been resettled. Some of them in temporary shelters until they can... I mean, temporary in the sense that they've been given just a few acres of land to work on for the time being, mm-hmm. while the government gets them more land. Mm-hmm. But I've been told they've all been resettled. There are also probably another 500,000 that had settled in what we call shanty towns, which means they had fled the fight areas where the fighting was taking place, and they just gone around the cities and built tent cities. Those have, most of them have returned, although some have opted for the so-called faster life of the cities. But the refugee situation was the top priority of the new administration. It has proceeded at a very drastic pace.
When you return to Zimbabwe, would you, for example, be able to travel freely in Namibia?
Travel freely, yes. In Namibia, no. Because to travel in Namibia, I would have to go through the government of South Africa. And I've been told that I have managed to acquire a very bad reputation in South Africa.
Why, I don't know. I'm such a nice guy. But, you know, we are under the, we are well aware of the fact that people that speak out against South Africa, South Africa has such a vast spy network, and which we have the option of choosing to remain silent and hoping that we'll be able to travel freely someday, or just speaking out what we feel, and we choose to speak out because when you see evil and keep silent. Somebody once said that for evil to triumph, it is enough that good people do nothing. I would like to go to Namibia. Maybe I can go and tell them that my name is Frank Johnson. Especially since I have acquired a Holden accent.
Specific that we can do, I mean, as
individuals or as a group? Oh, yeah. Okay, in the first place, what you did this week was a very good beginning. Well, I shouldn't say a beginning, it was a very good gesture. Buying a tractor for Zimbabwe, because that tractor is going to make a great deal of difference. It's going to probably be used by a whole village of people. In other words, it can, you know, go from family to family to family, plowing. Whereas without that, we might have had to use digging holes and probably plows with oxen. And that's not very efficient, as you well might know. So that's going to increase production. It's going to make life a whole lot simpler for a lot of people. And then, like I said, since you are voters, you may begin to be talking to your representatives, your Congress people, your president, just letting them know that you are not totally fooled by all these ideas about fighting communism, by letting them know that you have had a taste of African nationalism, and African nationalism cannot be equated with communism, that it is time for this country to begin to look at the Africans seriously and see the Africans as people and not simply as commodities or as a means of fighting this country's wars with the Soviets. So if you can begin to do that, that is a good beginning. And if you want to take a vacation, consider Zimbabwe. And also, since we are beginning to get involved, since Zimbabwe has now become a frontline state in the battle for the liberation of South Africa, whatever diplomatic efforts you can pursue will aid us as well as the South Africans. And like I said, we'd like to see a day when South Africans, our South African brothers, our Zanian brothers and sisters can also stand alongside us and say, today the battle will be a soccer match between Zimbabwe and Azania, and not today we need to go and blow up this place, so we need to go and negotiate with these people to let them realize that we need justice. I might add that that was one of the first things we did at our independence celebration. We were able for the first time to play soccer with the other Africans from Mozambique, Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, Tanzania. And either we were very good, or they were being very generous to us. but we managed to beat them all.
You guys they've been in training, perpetual training.
How much money is needed for a tractor?
Do you know?
John Trans could tell you.
It's around $20,000
$20,000 for a certain model. The kind of model that they're suggesting that would be useful in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, $20,000 sounds like a good round figure. You know, That's a lot of money, but when you look at the number of people that is going to affect, it could be as more than 100 people, 200 people that can benefit from it, not just once, but year after year after year. and when they increase production, the return from it is going to be well worth much, much more than 20,000.
If the tractor comes without the driver, I think they'll come back.
I have a feeling we can get a driver from Auckland.
Gasoline readily available for fueling?
Gasoline?
Yeah.
We touched on that last night, and we said that we may be able to start using gasohol. Mm. We grow a lot of sugar, which at one point was, we were challenging, is it Louisiana and Arkansas, mm-hmm. as the world's leading producers of sugar. So we're beginning to turn some of that sugar into gasohol, and I'm hoping that somewhere along the line I might be able to work with those people. It's something that I think can begin to make Zimbabwe about 60% dependent on, rather than, you know, because gasoline is very expensive, especially for us. And we're hoping that when Angola stabilizes and when Zaire and Congo, that have also a lot of oil, that we can begin to build pipelines that can bring our oil from another African country which will be closer by and also less expensive. Yeah. So gasoline probably shouldn't be too much of a problem.
You know, oil crops are another possibility where you can run diesel tractors like on sunflower oil, mm-hmm. or mixtures of diesel and oil crop oil, which also can.
Yeah, all of that research is being carried out at a place called Triangle Sugar Tea Estates. They are carrying on the sort of research whereby they can begin to use available resources to, you know, to power some of our machinery. I might add, though, that the problem Zimbabwe faces right now is that most of our machinery is World War II vintage, because we got most of our machinery just after the Second World War. Then we went into sanctions, and that meant that we could not get parts to machinery, and we could not get new machinery. So most of the money that we're getting right now, we'll have to go into replacing virtually every single machine that we have in Zimbabwe, and that's going to be quite a drain. But what I discovered is that during the first 6 months of the current administration, as a gesture of trying to help the country recover, the prime minister, the president, and almost all the black ministers were turning back their salaries to the government. They were supposed to be making about roughly $20,000 a year, I think. They were turning back virtually everything to the government as they gestured, you know, to help the country get started. And I'm hoping that this sort of gesture can be taken up by most of the people, including Fungai. And Fungai has the advantage that, having been a student for so long, poverty has become, shall we say, endemic.
Is there a lot of poverty in Zimbabwe and hunger?
The answer is yes and no. There was hunger, yes, but it was deliberate. The government was making a deliberate effort to make sure that the people starved. You know, as long as you don't give people food, you can keep them more or less in their place. But there was no need for that to have taken place. Right now, I can say there is no hunger, because the government, even though the government is just beginning, we've gotten to almost a point now where there should be no starvation anymore, where there should be no more hunger. Poverty, I think your economists have projected that Zimbabwe has the potential of becoming one of the wealthier countries, not just in Africa, but in the world. There is that much potential. Not only in terms of resources, but also in the sort of things that Zimbabwe can do, you know, to develop a healthy and viable economy. So the next several years are going to be very, very interesting. Did I see another question? Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly how to phrase it, but yesterday we were talking in another group about how you can't make a, we individually can't make a pencil because we don't know how. And then I was thinking about your 12 acres, mm-hmm. of each person having their own 12 acres to be productive. And I'm not sure that that goes together, but I was wondering how are you going to coordinate this, or how is it going to be organized so that everybody is helping one another rather than trying to make their own pencil, I guess. You know, trying to do their own thing. Is there some organization for these 12 acres that each person has? Like, are there thousands of acres that they're growing corn? Or, do you understand what I'm...
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure. I just wonder. That just came to my mind.
Okay, the thing is that the 12 acres are supposed to be specifically for food production. In other words, okay, when we grew up, almost all of us, we always had a little garden outside. I remember the trouble my father had trying to get me to go and work in the garden. That was a battle and a half, because I always figured that I was learning to become a sophisticated gentleman who can put on a suit and tie. That's why I'm glad that I finally come down to earth to realize the nobility of labor. You know, to realize that when you do something for yourself, if you go and grow tomatoes in your own garden and you get them and eat them, they're a lot more delicious than what you get from Safeway or whatever it is, that because they are from your own labor. Anyway, so the idea is that almost all of us can farm on a small scale. The government wants to get to a point where there can be no starvation. We can be self-sufficient in terms of food. But there will be other farms that will be there for the production of cash crops and for the production of fun. There will be a coordinated effort to teach these people, to teach all of us the best methods of farming, teach us how to, you know, the use of insecticides, pesticides, and what have you. So there will be, the Ministry of Agriculture is going to have a tremendous task. And each and every person in Zimbabwe now is supposed to be participating in passing on whatever knowledge they have. If I think I know about pesticides, then I tell my neighbor, and then I can open up, shall we say, a little school and be teaching everybody. Then I'm supposed to go around the country and, you know, that sort of thing. So there is a coordinated effort from the standpoint of the government. But basically, this will be done on an individual basis in terms of food production.
What about the cities now, people that live in the cities and all?
Mm-hmm.
What about their 12 acres? Say you live in the city and work in, can you rent it out or something?
Okay, no, you cannot rent it out.
You can't rent it out.
What happens in most cases is that even if I live in the city, I came from someplace. And where I came from, probably my parents are still there, or some relative is still there, and that relative will have those 12 acres.
Mm-hmm.
What we're concerned about is we don't want to have a nation of, what do you call them in this country, city slickers? People who just, you know, go to work and come home and then try to party and that sort of thing. We want to have a nation that is where everyone is.
Bureaucrats
is the word, yes.
What is roughly the percentage of Zimbabwe that's rural population and urban population? I mean, what place do the cities play?
Figures that I've received from the government indicate that only less than 20% of the population is urban. It was supposed to be growing fast, and the government was trying to hold this by making the rural areas attractive enough.
That's a deliberate policy.
Deliberate policy, yes. But you see, the reason that it was growing faster was simply because in most of the countryside, there are no jobs. A lot of times, people are just trying to scratch a living from, 2 acres of land that are not at all viable. So the government is now beginning to... The money that we're getting, for example, most of that is going to be spent in the countryside. And only a small portion is going to be spent in the cities. So when you have all those like rural industries, then you can have people staying out there and working on the countryside and staying away from the cities, which I think is a very good idea. Because when I go back myself, I doubt very seriously if I'll be working in the city. More than likely, I'll be like a country doctor, going from place to place and teaching the people this and that, sharing with them. And one other thing also is that while I'll be teaching them, they'll also be teaching me. Because we've come up with this concept of combining traditional medicine and Western medicine. Our Minister of Health is an MD, and he was the leading physician during the War of Independence. And he came up with this policy that he feels there are areas where Western medicine is fine, but there are other areas where it is inadequate. The same can be said for traditional medicine. And so by combining the two, we can come up with a health system that is more adequate for the needs of Zimbabwe. So I plan to spend the next 42 years and 6 months learning about integrating these two health systems.
What is the minimum age of retirement?
Minimum age of retirement is 69. So I have exactly 42 years and 6 months.
They have a mandatory retirement program?
They are working on that. They may, then again, they may not. We have had this problem of, I should have mentioned that, this idea that there are so many people entering the job market every year, and with an economy that has been stagnant for almost 15 years, it now has to grow by almost 8% per year for the next 5 years to be able to absorb all the job seekers, and that's going to be quite a task. It has grown by 8%, it grew by 9% this last year, and it's going to grow up by about the same percentage this year, but we don't think we can sustain this rate of growth.
It's very high.
Very difficult.
Do they then have, since we're talking about retirement, do they have retirement plans for the majority, or pension plans that people will have an income after retirement?
There was a time when retirement plans and pension plans were only for the white people. And also all social services were only for the white people. So the government that has come in has initiated a retirement plan for everybody now, and a pension plan for everybody. And they're even instituting a social security system, so I'm told. And so when I retire in 42 years, I'll have something to fall back on. And also we found out that social services like old people's homes, what few were available only for the white people. But now the government is extending health, all those to everybody. It has extended health facilities, free medical health, free medical coverage. What do you call it?
Insurance?
Not insurance. Okay, now everybody in Zimbabwe has access to free
healthcare.
Free healthcare, yes.
It's like health maintenance.
Right. Some free health to everyone who earns less than $250 a year. And as time goes on, this is going to be expanded. And as you can see, that covers basically almost all the Africans were covered by this, except for the so-called professionals coming from Washington State, from Oregon State, and from all these universities abroad. But the majority of the laborers would fall under this plan whereby they can have free health, free primary education. And that is going to help a great deal.
Is medical care expensive there?
No. Would you believe you can go to a hospital and pay $1?
No.
$1 admittance, yes. If you pay more than $10 for anything, that's exorbitant. That's like paying $2,000 a year.
And yet doctors aren't covered under a pension plan?
The doctors aren't covered under a pension plan?
Did you say they weren't? Did you say
under health?
Are professional people covered under the Social Security too?
Like I said, the government is not doing that for the first time for everyone. Before now, it was only white people who were covered.
But I wondered how a doctor could provide for his future and $10 a call.
Well, that's because most of these doctors are not private doctors. They work with through a hospital. There are very few private doctors that I can think of. With the private doctors, it might be slightly higher, but not by much.
Maybe also that has something to do with the concept of elitism, and that, you know, in this country and other countries perhaps, to be a doctor is to be a member of a very special elite, and the expectation is that you get a lot of money that goes with that, and you have a lifestyle which involves a lot of luxuries and special things that the other people don't have, and so you're up above them.
Yeah.
And it seems that if in Zimbabwe, the people, I don't know, I mean, like for yourself, I mean, you're saying that you're going to be going back and being kind of with the people instead of above them.
Yeah. That's what we hope to. Yeah, the cost of living in Zimbabwe is not all that bad, considering that if I go back home and make $200 a month, that should be more than sufficient for me to live quite comfortably. $200 a month would have the same $200 a month in Zimbabwe would have the same purchasing power as about $1,100 a month here, because I can rent a house for $50 a month, and groceries could cost me, if I'm being extravagant, probably $20 a month. So, also another thing that we are beginning to fight now is inflation. That was 15% last year, and we think that is ridiculous. If we can cut that back down to a more reasonable 2.5%.
Could you comment on the life of a black, say today, and say the near future in Zimbabwe, as opposed to Lesotho or some of these other black self-rule regions within South Africa? Is that tokenism? Do they really have self-rule and freedom? Or is that just a token type of thing?
Are you talking about Lesotho? Mm-hmm. Or are you talking about...
Let's say Orange Free State.
Oh, you're talking about the Bantustans within South Africa?
Within South Africa.
Okay. Mm. Well, all I can say about a black in Zimbabwe right now and within the next 5 years is that I have unlimited potential. I can be anything I want to be. In other words, I can make almost as much money as I am capable of doing. Whereas within South Africa, for example, I would be limited in that there are only so many things I can do. There are only so many professions, there are only so many jobs that I can do. You know, I think Zitulele mentioned yesterday the fact that, you have this pass that says where you were born and where you live, what sort of job you can do. So under those circumstances, my growth is very limited, and I can never expect to be, shall I say, wealthy or even capable of supporting myself. Whereas, like I said, in Zimbabwe, I can go on and become a filmmaker, another Ingmar Bergman, or I can go on and become, a leading medical researcher, a doctor, an economist, or whatever. In other words, the growth there. My growth in Zimbabwe will depend on me, how much I'm willing to work.
Well, these areas in South Africa then are really large ghettos where...
You got it. That's the word. They've been described as vast pools of migrant labor. In other words, since they have no economic viability, only thing that the people can do is to live there and go and work in the mines and in the cities and in the houses, and then try to come back home with you know, what few dollars they make.
In this country, you get the impression that these South African government is really generous by giving the blacks a certain area, letting them have self-rule and freedom.
Oh, wow.
That's the picture that we get here. So,
yeah, I'm sure Mavis Day is about to have a coronary when she hears something like that. Because you know, when they talk about giving these black people these lands to rule themselves, it's like being given, you know, in the first place, blacks make up about 71% of the population, and they have no right, according to the current system, that they have no legal right to any part of South Africa, except these vast pools of migrant labor, these homelands which make up less than 13% of the land, and in which there is no economic viability. The rainfall is very poor, the soil is about the worst, it's rocky, and you cannot grow anything. There are no industries. So in essence, what you do is you just go and live there and wait until such a time as you can find a job, then you go and work.
Like Indian reservations.
Like Indian reservations, yes. Yeah. I'm sincerely hoping that I will be able to see some of you in Zimbabwe within the next several years.
What if we all take you up on your invitation?
Sure. Sure. And you have the advantage that I found out not too long ago that I'm the only Fungai Kumbula in Zimbabwe and possibly in the world.